there is like a beauty in magical thinking. It can really help us cope and tap into our imagination. And it's really when you combine it with the overthinking of the information age that we're sort of displacing those instincts onto a more complex and cerebral world.
Amanda Montell is the host of the podcast Sounds Like a Cult, as well as the author of three books, including Cultish and The Age of Magical Overthinking, Notes on Modern Irrationality, which we will be talking about today. Each personal essay in this brand new book looks at a different cognitive bias, those irrational thought processes of our ancient, outdated hunter-gatherer brains that no longer serve us in our modern world. For this episode, Amanda covers many of these cognitive biases and explains why they were important for the survival of early humans, as well as how they currently manifest in a technologically advanced society that has very little in common with the distant past. Whether personal, cultural, or political, these thinking patterns affect us all in tremendous ways, and Amanda explains what we can do to understand, combat, and maybe even harness these cognitive biases to create a better life and a better world. I'm your host, Chelsea Weber Smith, and this is American Hysteria. Hi, Amanda. I am so thrilled that you are on our show right now. I finished your book this morning and I thought it was absolutely fantastic and so vital to everything that's happening right now and has always happened from the beginning of time. Thank you for being here. I really appreciate that.
Oh, the thrill is mine. Thank you for having me. That's a nice way to open. Thank you.
Yeah, a little drama to open.
Appreciate it.
So I think the reason that I call it vital is that on our show, we do talk a lot about cognitive biases, and there's this part missing from, I think, a larger conversation in our world that has to do with these ways that our brains work without us truly being aware, because we still have the same brains that we had before civilization, essentially.
Yes.
And that's a pretty big deal. And it's really something that maybe we don't want to think about because we hope we're beyond things like that. But basically, your book has tackled a whole bunch of these different ways that our brains betray us. And so I would love to just start with, what made you want to write a book? Because you at some point say in your book that this is the book you always wanted to write. So that feels like a big deal, right? So what was it that got you really into this, and why did it feel so vital to you to write?
Yeah, well, oh gosh. I mean, I dreamt of writing books from a pretty young age. I think I came to the terrifying conclusion that I wanted to try to pursue a career as an author when I was like 19. I remember being like very afraid of that ambition in myself and like being like, what do I do? Like, you know, because you've been a child up until college and you're like, everything's pretend. And then you're like, oh no, these like Delulu visions for my life that I've had, I actually want to try to accomplish. That's so scary. So this is my third book, and it really does feel like a culmination of everything that's ever felt important to me. I mean, I keep joking that this book feels like my goodbye tour. Like everyone I've ever cared about, like every piece of writing that's ever meant anything to me has a place in this book. But the sort of thesis of it crystallized for me over the past few years as I was just contemplating this notion that despite living in the information age, life only seems to be making less sense. And it certainly doesn't seem to be feeling any better. And then as I was researching my last book, Cultish, which is about the language of cults from Scientology to Soul Cycle, so this wide spectrum of groups, I kept coming across all this really fascinating psychology and behavioral economics research that made mention of cognitive biases, some of the more famous ones like confirmation bias and the sunk cost fallacy, as part of the explanation for why cult followers would say stay in the Moonies for longer than made sense to anyone else, including them, you know. But I couldn't help but notice how these biases also illuminated so many of the everyday behaviors that I was seeing in the culture at large, and also some of my own confounding choices that I could never even explain to myself, like my decision in my early 20s to stick out a romantic relationship that really felt like a cult of one sort of dynamic that I kept justifying to myself and hoping would get better, even though there was no evidence to suggest that was true. Or, you know, my tendency to engineer online enemies based on conflicts I'd invented in my own head. And so there are hundreds of cognitive biases that have been described over the years. For the book, I essentially chose my 11 faves, the 11 that I thought felt the most urgent, the most relevant to what I was observing in the zeitgeist, ones that I felt like could really relate to many of the observations that I'm sure readers were also noticing, like, you know, extreme cycles of celebrity worship and dethronement, or, you know, nostalgia and how that works for better and for worse in our minds, or like our embrace of Instagram manifestation gurus. So the book was just like this opportunity to really follow my curiosities and play and blend genres. And it was just like an absolute blast to write and very cathartic.
Yeah, I imagine it was, because you also put yourself in the hot seat a lot, you know, which I think is probably one of the best ways to invite people into conversation, is to say, I do this.
Totally.
I'm admitting this.
Yes.
And, you know, I have had these experiences that I'm going to share with you to illuminate this particular bias. And you do that so masterfully. And
thank
so
you.
I wanted to know if there was one of these particular biases that you feel like you most related to as a chronic overthinker, because of course your book is about overthinking, like when you were growing up.
Oh, as I was growing up.
Yeah.
Okay, so as a young person, I feel like proportionality bias really dominated a lot of my delusion. So proportionality bias is the second bias I tackle in the book. It is the theme of a chapter called I Swear I Manifested This. And I talk about proportionality bias in the context of arguing that manifestation is its own kind of conspiracy theory. So I will sort of explain what I mean by that. Proportionality bias is this proclivity to think that big events or even big feelings must have had a big cause. It just makes proportional sense to us to misattribute cause and effect in this way. So, you know, on a grand scale, it would be, you know, a global pandemic strikes. This is such, you know, an immense calamity. It could not have been simply the result of a bunch of small random misfortunes. A government must have engineered it on purpose. That's the only way this seems to make sort of cosmic logic in our minds. I also argue in the book that manifestation, while positive and rooted in some truth that like your mindset can totally influence outcomes, is also a kind of misattribution of cause and effect. This idea that, you know, if you only vision board hard enough, then, you know, you can reclaim some agency over your life during times of tumult or unpredictability. And that can have some pretty nefarious consequences. And I've noticed in the current age that a lot of these online manifestation gurus who are claiming to have this like bespoke manifestation technique that you can sign up for $30 a month to access have sent some followers down a much more pernicious conspiratorial QAnon-y rabbit hole, because some of the psychology and behavioral economics at the root is really the same. But I find, and I argue in this chapter, that anybody who's ever attributed a larger than life cause that was actually unrelated to the larger than life effect that they're like trying to parse out has a pinch of conspiracy theorist in them. It really comes down to, like, you know, when your phone isn't working or when your car is acting up and you're like, why are you doing this to me? Like, the technology has human intention that is conspiring against me. You know, we all have this impulse to, like, project this overly simplistic intentionality onto, you know, problems that we encounter that don't naturally make sense to us or don't have, like, a sort of clear rationale behind them. And, you know, kids do this all the time. Like, kids are sort of the OG magical thinkers coming up with, you know, like, superstitions and play pretend games. And there is, like, a beauty in magical thinking as well. Like, it can really help us cope and tap into our imagination and things like that. It's really when you combine it with the overthinking of the information age that it starts to get kind of painful and sinister and dangerous and those things. But it's almost like magical thinking. Anyone who has OCD will relate to this, obviously. You know, you think that, like, rituals will result in protecting your family. And I think, you know, a lot of kids, and I remember as a kid engaging in certain rituals, hoping that they would have, you know, this big effect on my life or in the safety of my loved ones, you know.
Definitely.
And I don't engage in those rituals in the same way anymore. But yeah, growing up, I definitely found myself doing a ton of that. And I still have proportionality bias in my daily life. Like, we as human beings adapted for paranoia. Like, when you think about human beings living in a physical world without technology or modern culture, like, if something huge happened in nature, like, I don't know, like a branch falling, like, it was probably from a humongous gust of wind, you know, like, yes. It was, and we did adapt for a world full of, you know, hostile intentions and threats and things. It's just that we're sort of displacing those instincts onto a more complex and cerebral world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, something that really kind of got in my head about the proportionality bias is that I think a lot of our culture around therapy and psychology, you know, we have these big feelings kind of no matter who you are. A lot of us have big anxiety. We have, you know, deep problems with overthinking. We have, you know, this sense that something huge must have caused these things. And yeah, I was part of this self-actualization group when I was a kid into my teen years. And there was a huge emphasis on, like, we have to dig back and find, even if you don't remember it, we've got to dig back and find that big thing that caused all of your problems right now. And, you know, a lot of people there were just like, well, I don't have that big thing. Mm-hmm. And it felt like we've got to find that big justification for these big feelings.
Yeah.
And that feels kind of similar in a lot of ways to this, but just kind of projected back into the past.
Yes, that's such a good point, because even this is, like, really meta, but, like, even throughout this book launch process for a book about overthinking, it's so stressful, like, to have to talk about yourself so much, like, in public, you know. It feels, like, really, really wrong. And I feel really good today.
I'm glad to hear it.
But yeah, but until the book came out, you know, I was just feeling, like, anxious all the time and, like, crying, like, why am I doing this? You know, writing the book felt really good, and then promoting the book felt really bad. And I was like, you know, I have all of these big feelings, and, like, I'm unwell and all this stuff. And I was thinking, like, but I don't deserve to feel this way, because, you know, when I was thinking back on, like, all of the contributing factors, it was, like, a bunch of small things. And I was like, well, that hasn't earned me the right to, like, need these, you know, more significant interventions. Like, you know, there wasn't, like, that one big trauma. And you're totally right. Like, that is, like, my proportionality bias at work.
Yeah, it's, these biases are wild.
Yeah.
Okay. So is there one particular bias that was most kind of surprising to you when you started to read about it that kind of shook you a little bit to your core?
Yeah. Well, there, a lot of them. But there is a chapter in the book that covers something called overconfidence bias, which is defined by a few qualities, some of which are the near universal tendency to over attribute positive outcomes to ourselves, to like overestimate our knowledge or capabilities in certain arenas like driving or sex, sure. or cooking. And going into that chapter, I originally wanted to explore the Dunning-Kruger effect, which is a phrase that I had come across multiple times, which describes just sort of like colloquially the tendency for people who know the least about a subject to most overestimate their expertise. And it's a sort of license for a lot of people to kind of feel smug, like, you know, only the dumbest people think that they're so smart, and like the smartest people know their limits. And the Dunning-Kruger effect is often called upon by pundits and cultural commentators to lambast, you know, like ding-dongs on the internet who claim that they know things that they don't. And then I started looking into the Dunning-Kruger effect, and I very quickly came across a sort of like post-mortem on this original study that was co-authored by David Dunning, the social scientist. And it was revisiting some sort of like fallacious conventional wisdom that had been spread based on this study. It's actually not that people with the least expertise are the only ones who overestimate themselves. Everybody does it. Absolutely everybody, no matter what their level of expertise is in a certain field, will likely, you know, sort of aggrandize their morality or their expertise across various subjects. It's just that people who are really, really smart or well-educated in one subject will tend to do that over like a smaller range of subjects. But everybody alive overestimates themselves. And this was a really tough pill to swallow, because I was like, surely this bias cannot apply to me. Like, I am a normal person. I hate myself. But of course. But then it's like, well, actually, there is a sort of positive side to overcrediting yourself with certain outcomes or mistaking another person's knowledge for your own. That really reflects the idea that human beings are so, so collaborative, and we are so good at making things happen together that we tend to sort of like forget where our knowledge ends and another person's begins. Like, we have these fuzzy cognitive brain barriers, and that really helps us drive progress. You know, it's like we are constantly overreaching ourselves. And there's a certain element of that that's really good. Like, if everyone who engaged in grassroots activism had to have a PhD in global politics, like, I don't think anything would ever be accomplished. And, you know, if I had to know exactly what I wanted to say when I set out on a writing project, like, I would never write books. So, you know, we, you know, so many of us really like push past our limits in a way that's sometimes really lovely and sometimes absolutely catastrophic, as we can see in so many overconfident populist leaders. So finding out that the Dunning-Kruger effect didn't say exactly what we thought it did, and also finding out that overconfidence is present in all of us, was kind of shocking.
And I like the idea that people could be wrong about a cognitive bias and to use their own cognitive biases to then twist that other cognitive bias to misunderstand it.
Totally.
Feels very us.
Yes, so us.
More after this.
You ever notice how finding time and energy to do the most basic human necessity, eat literal food, has become just another exhausting task jammed into our increasingly inhuman schedules? Well, your spring can be a little more stress-free with Factor. Factor will provide you with delicious, never frozen, ready to eat gourmet meals that are chef crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Each week, you get to choose from a menu of 35 options to create your perfect breakfast, lunch, or dinner with absolutely no prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. And Factor makes sure you get exactly what you want. You can tailor deliveries to your schedule and customize how many meals you want each and every week, and you can pause anytime. So just head to factormeals.com/AmericanHysteria50 and use code AMERICANHYSTERIA50 American Hysteria 50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code American Hysteria 50 at factormeals.com/AmericanHysteria50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Check out Factor today.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
And now, back to the show. All right, if we've done kind of the confirmation bias that unnerved you, what is the one that comforted you the most when you learned about it?
Ooh, great question. Okay, so the last chapter in the book talks about a bias called the IKEA effect, which is kind of fun. And it describes our penchant to overvalue products that we helped create, especially if we made them with our own hands. And I found this really quaint. It's just like so delusional, but also adorable to think that like just because we contributed to someone's crowdfunding campaign or like because we helped build our own piece of IKEA furniture, that that thing is like so much more beautiful and so much more valuable and that we want to like show it to our friends and overprice it after we sell it on Facebook Marketplace or when we list it or whatever. And I found that so interesting, especially in the context of this time when, you know, technology is moving so, so exponentially quickly. And, you know, there's a lot of fear surrounding AI taking the place of artists and us not being able to work with our hands in this curative, like profoundly human way anymore because like the robots might do it. And so like working through some of that and also sort of taking the temperature down on some of that alarmism and fear was a really cool exercise for that last chapter.
Do you want to tell us about the precious thing that you made?
Oh, which one? I mean,
I'm talking about your cushion.
The cushion. The yeah, cushion. I'm looking at it right now.
And how do you feel when you look at it?
I feel more proud of it than ever. So, yeah, I mean, I do not identify as particularly crafty. Like, I don't think I'm really patient enough for crocheting and sewing and like all these things that would reflect so well on me and that would allow me to like really fulfill my cottagecore homesteader fantasy. Yeah, I don't work well with my hands. But during the pandemic, I did, or during lockdown, I should say, I did sew something very special. I had bought a big girl office chair on Facebook Marketplace. It's very aesthetic. It's like beech wood. It's super like Scandi, Japandi. I'm obsessed with it, but not comfortable for the derriere. So I decided to make an attempt at sewing my own seat cushion. And so I made this really janky green personal pizza sized, you know, circular seat cushion stuffed with the innards of a discarded dog toy, might I add.
Beautiful.
And I am so proud of it. Like, I show it to everybody. I think it is the most important object in this place. Like, I'm like, this book, who cares? This seat cushion is all I want to talk about.
It's the pinnacle.
Yeah. And it was just like so funny to like read about this cognitive bias and be like, oh, this applies to something I did literally 2 months ago. Or, oh God, with everything I write about, whether it's like cultishness or cognitive biases. It always like generates a sort of appreciation in me for how mystical and communal and silly and quaint human beings are. Like, I think speaking of not knowing where our knowledge ends and another person's begins, we actually don't even know where our knowledge ends and the computer's begins. Like, this is actually a described phenomenon called the Google effect. We fail to remember the information that we learn via web search, but we also fail to recognize that we have forgotten it. Like, we think we know everything we've ever Googled. And that is so silly. But I think it also generates a certain amount of ego in us. We're like, everything is knowable. I am so smart because of Google. But actually, like, we are not meant to, like, be able to continue to, like, hold that much information in our minds. We have limited time, limited cognitive resources, limited memory storage. We are the same sort of, like, Stone Age brains that we've always been, and yet we're not aware of that. So there is this ego that, like, we can know everything under the sun, and yet we're simultaneously like sewing. So I'll speak for myself. I'm sewing these like shoddy seat cushions and thinking like I'm Michelangelo. So humans are so silly.
Yes, we very much are. And okay, so one of my favorite moments in the book is when you talk about how humans, though we've always had, you know, fear and we've always had a certain sense of anxiety, it really wasn't until the dawn of reason and the Middle Ages and those times that we really started to be our minds were robbed of faith, I think is how you put it. And you also quoted Denis Tuary, who wrote that the new science-empowered mind that dared to know was also, quote, a vulnerable mind robbed of the medieval certainty of faith. And I think on our show, that's something I like to talk about a lot, because we've kind of written off faith as this sort of, you know, old timey thing that we don't really need anymore in the age of science and technology and progress. But really, it leaves us very vulnerable to overthinking and to just kind of this fracturing that happens when, again, you have all the knowledge in the world essentially at your fingertips, but we kind of lack the sense of community and shared myth that used to unite groups of people and kind of be this thing that we could fall back on. And so I would love if you would give us a little bit about your relationship to faith and what faith can be in the information age.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I would not trade now for the Middle Ages.
Certainly not.
Anyway, yeah, I think, you know, I don't want to demonize the democratization of information. Like, it is so much better to have access to knowledge and for it not to be kept on this high throne, like, just for I always end up saying queen instead of king and queen, which I actually love. It's like the gender nooch version.
Queen.
For royalty. Just kept on the high throne for royalty and, you know, scribes back in the day when like almost no one could read. Like, yeah, sure. Probably no one suffered from information overload the way that we do now, but that was worse.
Of course, yes.
And yet, yeah, there is a sense of security and communality and ritual in these faith communities that can be really healing as long as you can participate within the space of ritual time. That's a concept that I talk about in my book, Cultish. I learned about this concept of ritual time from a writer named Gary Eberl, who wrote a book called Dangerous Words. And he talks about how, you know, ritual and sort of metaphysical belief and things like that can be really healing and awe-inspiring as long as they take place in this specific space and time where there's like a ritual to signify you're entering that space and time. There is a ritual to signify that you're exiting it. And it doesn't sort of like follow and dictate in an absolutist or dogmatic way every decision that you make throughout your entire life. And that's where things get dangerous. And I think as we confront so much chooser's paradox in our lives right now. Like there is at least the illusion of like endless possibilities for where your life could go, what job you could have, what hair color you could have, in addition to this real sense of isolation that we feel in a culture of like digital age capitalism, and that pressure to know everything under the sun, this kind of lie that says that, you know, everything is knowable. All of those things combined have created like a really tense cultural environment. And that can make the space for sort of secular religions to become really fanatical and cult-like. Yes, faith in traditional religion is declining in so many places all over the world. And yet that craving for meaning and connection and ritual is going nowhere. And so we are putting our faith in, you know, Reddit forums or pop standums. And sometimes those interactions get really like crusades level brutal. And that can be freaky. But yeah, I know I said it in a way just a moment ago, but like, every time I look into one of these topics, whether it's cults or cognitive biases, I find myself like wanting to engage in that stuff more. Like, yeah. I writing a book about cults and how cultishness shows up in everyday life just kind of made me want to like tap into my mysticism a little bit more, like within the space of that ritual time. Because, yeah, I don't want to like completely write off irrationality or superstition. Like, that stuff is so human and can really help us during certain times. Like, no one has the answers to the most existential questions in life. And so like, whatever you gotta do to like cope with life on earth, like I think like it sometimes makes sense to do things that don't make sense, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does.
But within this sort of protected space where you can have this kind of skeptical twinkle in your eye. I don't know if that answers your question.
It absolutely does. And I mean, you've done a lot of work around cults, as you mentioned. Your last book was about cults. You have a podcast around things that approximate cults. And I was curious, too, about when you're talking about what we were just talking about, you know, having to have this set time where you get to practice ritual, because otherwise it's going to take over your entire life, which often means that some kind of charismatic leader is going to be taking over your life. And what do you think is the cognitive bias that is most responsible for the extremes that we go to with this type of overthinking? You know, what is the bias that pushes us into things that are cults or approximate cults?
Yeah, well, oftentimes a whole bunch of these biases are working together at once, you know, like the first one that came to mind when you asked the question was confirmation bias. This is the cognitive bias that gets the most play in like headlines and things like that. But it's our tendency to only seek out and identify and remember information that validates what we already believe while, you know, ignoring, discarding, forgetting information that controverts it. And yet, you know, that bias almost never works alone, because, you know, if someone else is right about something, that will trigger our zero sum bias or our tendency to think that another person's gain inherently means your loss. And so if another person is a little bit right about something, that can feel like it's taking away from you being right about that thing. And so then you start feeling really competitive and you dig your heels in. You're like, no, really, I'm correct. And you start cherry picking even more information to defend that. I came across this really sort of startling fun fact that the increase in science literacy has not actually helped us become better at identifying real facts. It's just made us better at defending our existing beliefs with cherry-picked science.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Oh, no. Indeed. So that's kind of horrifying. Yeah, I think the information age is causing the global attention span to shrink. We are not necessarily getting better at thinking critically all on our own, just because there's more to critically think about. And confirmation bias is this, you know, really, really powerful cognitive inclination because it just helps us make efficient decisions. It's like if we didn't have confirmation bias, we would agonize over every tiny life choice, you know, like we would dwell on questions from like, should I have ordered a salad instead of fries with my lunch, to like, should I have gone to, you know, a cheaper university? It's like we constantly are looking for evidence that we made the right choice, that we are currently making the right choice. And that just helps us move forward and survive. However, as the world becomes more complicated, as our problems become more abstract, it's just, you know, ever important to become aware of those things. And while we are pretty bad at changing other people's minds with facts and data, studies suggest that we are much better at changing our own minds. And so, yeah, just, I mean, I've found that becoming aware of confirmation bias in particular in myself has helped to a degree. At least it's like opened up conversations about it. And I just always try to learn to stomach cognitive dissonance a little bit more than I otherwise would. I feel like a responsibility to do that. But it is very difficult.
Yes, certainly is. And so you also talk about in the cult vein that there is a such thing as a cult of one in a toxic relationship. I think there are, you know, it could be romantic, it could be parental, but that there is this propensity in many of us to enter into those types of relationships. And I think one of the biases that you mention having to do with that is the sunk cost fallacy. So would you give us a little overview of the sunk cost fallacy and maybe how it plays into our culture in a bigger way?
Yeah. So the sunk cost fallacy, this is another one that's a little bit more famous, but this one describes our tendency to think that resources already spent on an endeavor, money, time, but also emotional resources like hope or secrets, justifies spending even more. So, you know, a really low stakes example would be like, I am playing poker, I've already, you know, put so much on the table, I can't fold now, even though my cards are bad. Or I don't know if anyone has ever had the experience of, you know, getting 100 episodes into a TV show, you don't even like it anymore, but you're like, I'm this far in, like, I have to finish it. Those are some scenarios that don't really matter that much. Well, I guess depending on if you're a high gambler, then it could be with poker.
It might matter. But
I found that it really can apply to our personal relationships as well. And this is the most sort of personal chapter that I write in the book about my own experience with the most irrational choice I think I've ever made was the decision to stay for many, many years in a romantic relationship that really felt like a cult. And the worse it got, the more I told myself, like, commit harder. Like, surely the win that you were promised is just around the corner. Like, any day now, it'll get better, even though there was only evidence to suggest the opposite. But it really goes back to this loss aversion that is very natural to us humans. And also the idea that, like, again, we are social creatures and it behooves us to seem predictable to ourselves. Like, it doesn't feel good to recognize and cop to the idea that you made a bad bet on yourself, that you, you know, were not aware of what would make you happy, that you made a choice that caused you great suffering, and that, you know, you've posted so many happy looking photos of you and your partner online, and yet, like, it's not helping. And you don't want to create the impression that you're some kind of loose cannon. And so in the digital age in particular, I find that the sunk cost fallacy really motivates our decisions to stay in relationships with people that we've really flaunted on social media as being like our perfect match. And I definitely suffered from that. And, you know, learning about the sunk cost fallacy and how it related to this choice of mine really helped me sort of forgive myself, because it made me feel like I was not just some total irrational, pathetic pathetic nincompoop, you know, like there was this sort of behavioral economics reason for my choice that is, you know, pretty relatable. And anyone who's ever, you know, doubled down on their decision to stay in a job that isn't serving them anymore or anything like that can probably relate to this. But yeah, very healing chapter to write. I'll say that.
I'm glad it was healing to read. And I bet it was for a lot of people, too. More after this. And now back to the show. So I think that what you're talking about to me also relates in this bigger way to the sunk cost of getting into a certain political mindset or getting into conspiracy theories or following totally. A particular candidate. It really could be anyone. And just being like, I've invested my emotions, my thinking, my time into this, and I've formed, you know, likely relationships to other people who share this belief structure, and losing that would be not only scary, but also feel like I wasted my time and I was stupid in some way. And so
yes.
The other thing that reminded me of, and I think it was in your confirmation bias section, you have this sentence that said, if changing your mind means losing your tribe, it's not worth it. Mm. And that's very like, that's one that hit me really hard because I think we've all had that experience where we encounter information that challenges our belief structure, that challenges our candidate, that challenges something mm-hmm. that means a lot to us politically.
Right.
And sometimes I think all of us reject that information. And I think that is one of those biases that we all need to really be thinking about. But it still comes from this place of like wanting community and not yes. wanting to lose that. So can you talk a little bit about how that kind of worked in, I don't know, a prehistorical way? Or like, why is that a bias that we have today, do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, we have always been these like intensely collaborative social creatures who don't survive very well on our own. And also for most of human history, the problems that we needed to solve every single day were more physical, like they were less mm-hmm. cerebral, they were less complicated, there was less sort of like mis and disinformation, you know, and so we developed these psychological shortcuts to handle a set of problems that really just related to survival in the physical world, and that had so much to do with our social relationships and making sure that we could stay a part of our community because that was so much better for survival, whether that means, you know, aligning ourselves with a certain role model or, you know, seeking out information that, you know, suggests that your tribe is better than another or, you know, coming up with a fight or flight response to protect yourself from a threat that came from like a more physical stimulus or something like that. Mm-hmm. But now we're applying those psychological shortcuts to scenarios that they weren't really meant for. Right. It's like I do talk in the book about how I have always been mystified by my own panic response in reaction to something as non-threatening as like a curt email or like, sure. you know, an Instagram comment that was like kind of salty that was left on my account like 3 days ago when I didn't see it. And it's like not actually a threat to me, but, you know, I'm seeing it.
But you think you're going to die.
But I think yeah. I'm going to die. Yeah. And that has like so much to do with these cognitive inclinations that develop to help us, you know, react to potential threats that like really could lead to our demise in the physical world. You know, if like something was new to you, new information to you, like the sound of rustling in the bushes or whatever, like that probably meant that that could be a predator, or at the very least, you know, it wouldn't hurt to react like it was to save your own hide. But now we're sort of reacting to Instagram conflicts or pretend conflicts as if they're like a rustling in the bushes that could attack us. And that is just serving no one. one. But yeah, I mean, consistently, I just keep coming back to the idea that like a lot of these biases developed for an evolutionary purpose, or at least they developed as a sort of side effect that for a long time didn't hurt us. And now because of the culture that we've created, they are hurting us. You know, like, yes, it's very important to protect your community and make sure that you're not ousted by them. But as, yeah, problems become political and disembodied, you know, we're often like communicating with people that we've never met in person. We just, it's becoming our responsibility to be able to tolerate disagreement. And yet we're only seeming to tolerate it less. These are like some of the ideas that I don't claim to like definitively solve in the book, but they're the ideas that I'm reckoning with for sure.
Certainly. And also what you said, you mentioned it a little bit, but I was going to ask you about the negativity bias, which I think is one that haunts my soul as well as it sounds like yours. And yeah. I think many of those highly sensitive people out there, or just regular people, everybody's sensitive. They just hide it better. But you know, this idea that we will focus on one negative comment, yeah. even if it comes padded in like a sea of positive comments. Right. And you actually referred to it in a way that I thought was so good as a snake in the field of flowers. And I was wondering if you would just extrapolate a little bit on negativity bias. And again, like, how did that serve us in a time when, you know, predators were a bigger problem for us than, you know, frightening thoughts that we just manifest on our own.
Yeah. Negativity bias. Oh my God. What a validating concept to learn about. It is this tendency to assign greater weight to unfavorable events. So like you said, you know, we internalize the one insult we got in a litany of compliments so much more. Like if you were to get 10 hugs and one slap in the face, like you would not remember any of the hugs. You know what I mean?
Right.
And yeah, I describe it in the book as like an insult in a litany of compliments is today's rattlesnake in a field of flowers. And that connects to, yeah, this more adaptive thing where like, if you were in a field of magnolias and you noticed a snake, it would not behoove you to like ignore the one snake and focus on the flowers, even if the snake actually just turned out to be a stick, even if it wasn't really a threat. Zeroing in on that one potential threat could help you. But now we are sort of hyper fixating on negativity when it really doesn't make any evolutionary sense to do so. We haven't outgrown that tendency. So yeah, there are a lot of websites that I don't go on.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Don't read the reviews, people.
No.
Or maybe do. I don't know. Maybe that's a better thing to do and like exercise that muscle.
No, I don't feel the need to. I spare myself. Because the thing too is just like, it's not natural to be exposed to so many opinions.
No.
You know, even reading a whole bunch of like positive reader reviews makes me feel anxious and squirmy because it just makes me feel really exposed. Right. You know what I mean? And it's like, I know in theory that when I write a book, other people will read it. But unless I am having a conversation with them the way that you and I are right now, it tends to feel like, oh my God, like, how'd you get that? Like, why are you reading that?
My
you
diary, know, like, yeah.
My diary, like, leave me alone. It's weird.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think people who are creative, who are sharing their work, probably in general feel like that, unless perhaps the overconfidence bias is largely at play for them.
I would even imagine, I don't think anybody is spared from feeling, well, if they are, I mean, maybe I would take a freaking self-actualization workshop from them. Like, I would love to learn how to not care so much about what the rogue strangers who happen not to connect with something that I've written have to say. But I don't think I ever will. Like, being sensitive is such like an important part of being a a creative person. Absolutely. Or like a person in general. It's like, we should care what people think. It's just that we shouldn't have to care what the entire internet thinks.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah. These are like constantly like all of the ideas that I'm trying to hold in my mind at the same time. It's like, I am very porous when it comes to other people's feedback. And yet, in the age of the internet, I will just get flooded, you know, mm-hmm. like I can't be that porous. So it's a tough balance. And I don't think anyone has like the answers for how to navigate it, but I'm trying.
Being aware of it is the first step, right? So you talk about the halo effect, which feels appropriate to talk about now with this. And I would love if you could, for our audience, explain the halo effect, because when we're talking about people who are looking up to some public figure, there are these assumptions that we make that are projected onto that person and then can make us desire to also take them down in some way eventually. So would you give us a little primer on the halo effect?
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so the halo effect is the first cognitive bias that I talk about in the book. I was like very eager to cover it the second I learned what it was. It is our proclivity to admire one quality in a person and then jump to the conclusion that they are perfect overall. So, you know, we like a pop star's music, so we assume that they must also be, you know, educated, worldly, maybe align politically with us, since we are sort of seeing them as like an aspirational role model figure. You know, we like an influencer's sense of style. We follow them. We start to get invested in them parasocially. We start jumping to conclusions that they are congenial and smart and, you know, wealthy and all these things that there's little to no evidence to suggest that they are. And that can set up some expectations that ultimately aren't healthy for the fan or the subject of their fandom. And again, there is a sort of evolutionary reason for the halo effect. Back in earlier days in human history, if you saw someone in your community with like big muscles and intact teeth, you might think like, oh, that person must be a skilled hunter or a skilled fighter and thus, you know, good to align with for survival purposes. I want that person in my corner, even if they, you know, had good muscles for another reason other than being a good hunter. It was like, you know, fair enough. It was a good enough conclusion to jump to, but we're now mapping those tendencies onto these modern parasocial relationships involving celebrities and influencers, again, in this much more complicated time. And that is what I think is responsible for so many of the cycles of celebrity worship and dethronement that we see these days.
Absolutely. And it kind of relates too to another cognitive bias that you talk about, declinism.
Yeah.
In your chapter called Nostalgia Porn. Again, probably very relatable to many people. And you talk about the way that we take these figures from the past, say Britney Spears, Paris Hilton, and we look at them through a new lens and sort of cleanse them of the qualities that were once ascribed to them by tabloids, by us, right? Let's admit it, right? Like by people who saw them negatively because that's kind of what we were fed to believe. And now they're having a moment in the nostalgia, the warm glow of nostalgia, and we see them differently. And that extends far beyond people. So would you talk a little bit about declinism and your section about nostalgia porn?
Yeah. So a lot of these cognitive biases have an effective analog. So I talked about zero sum bias, that tendency to think another person's gain means your loss. That could sort of correlate to envy. Like envy is to zero sum bias as nostalgia is to declinism. So yeah, declinism is this idea that life and society are just getting worse and worse and worse irreversibly, and it's all downhill from there. The human mind is kind of like weird about time. You know, we tend to romanticize the past. We tend to like overly freak out about the present. And then we sort of like devalue the future. We tend to think that the future is like dismissible or scary. You know, a lot of us don't like to think about the future, or if we do think about the future a lot, it tends to be with like great anxiety. Right. So during times of present pain, we don't tend to think about the future explicitly. We tend to sort of idealize the past or even a past that we never knew. And that sort of creates this idea that some distant bygone era was superior to the present. And following from there, things are probably only getting worse. But actually, I went into that chapter thinking like, oh, nostalgia is dangerous. Like, it just paves the way for delusion and for the weaponization of figures like Donald Trump to say, make America great again and stuff like that. But then I talked to a bunch of scholars of nostalgia. And every time I talk to academics who are experts in the subjects that I'm interested in looking into, they always fill me with a sense of hope. They always ground me. It's a really nice feeling. But a lot of these nostalgia scholars were saying that actually what's called personal nostalgia, or the nostalgia that you might have of your own memories, even if it's a little bit romanticized and not totally accurate, it's a coping mechanism that's really healthy. It helps us, you know, generate a sense of imagination and thus hope for the future. Like, if we romanticize a memory that we had, it makes us feel like, oh, maybe I could have memories that are that positive again. It helps you, you know, dream of days to come. Nostalgia only starts to get sinister when public populist figures, from, you know, political figures to influencers even, start to weaponize and exploit visions of a distant past that never existed as a way to catastrophize the current moment and sell the public on a vision of the future based on that total revision of the past.
And then there's also, like you're saying, this idea of nostalgia relates so much to populist politics. Make America great again. You mentioned that not just Donald Trump, but George Bush has used it. Bill Clinton used it. Ronald Reagan used it. You know, it is a very popular way to get people to believe that there will be this resurrection of this old kind of perfection that we lost through, you know, depending on who's talking, some modern process. And I think that it's really important to get a grip on these biases, and we may not be able to do it with other people, but there is hope in us doing it for ourselves. But, you know, you mentioned it's difficult to get people to face their own biases, but have you found a way, even though it's difficult, to use this information that you have to perhaps get to the people who would be less willing to confront their own biases? Like, do you feel like just learning about these biases alone can just get into people's heads enough that maybe something rearranges a bit?
Sometimes it depends on the bias. So there's one bias in the book called the illusory truth effect, which describes our penchant to hear something repeated multiple times and then mistake it as true. Yeah. We, you know, sort of confuse processing fluency, as it's called, with accuracy. And unfortunately, with a bias like that, even an awareness of it doesn't help.
Maybe like, does the opposite. Yeah.
Yeah. If we hear something over and over and over again, even if it's like blatantly untrue, impossible, or whatever, we really do tend to internalize it as a fact. And so the sort of counter to that might just be to like spread more accurate information, you know, like as much as possible, to make accurate information sound catchier and thus more engaging and more easy to repeat and stuff like that. But with some of the other biases, like sunk cost fallacy and declinism, I actually have really found that, at least for me, becoming aware of them has influenced my behavior in some capacity. Related to the sunk cost fallacy, there is a study that I quote in that chapter that talks about additive versus subtractive solution bias. Basically, like, as human beings naturally, but especially growing up in consumerist society, we tend to think that in order to solve a problem, any problem, we should add something to the equation rather than taking something away. So this study involved presenting participants with a set of colored blocks and a sort of like visual puzzle that they could solve by either adding or subtracting colored blocks. And the much more efficient way to solve the problem would be to take a block away. But the vast majority of participants opted for the much more cumbersome way of like adding a whole bunch of blocks to solve the problem, mm-hmm. which just shows like how deep seated this is. And I find it in my life in so many different ways. Like whenever I am struggling with a certain anxiety or even just like clutter in my house, I mean, get this. I was looking at my junk drawer in my home the other week and I was just like, oh God, what a mess. You know what would solve this? If I went to the Container Store and got some like acrylic drawer organizers, you know, like that would solve the problem. It didn't naturally occur to me to be like, no, just throw some things away. And this applies to, you know, different areas of life, like that relationship that I described in that chapter. Whenever we were experiencing our worst moments, I used to think like, no, you know what we need to solve our problems? We need to go on another vacation or replace our furniture or like add something maximalist to our lives. It really did not occur to me to maybe like break up, you know? Sure. So yeah, I found that with some of these biases, an awareness of them has really helped, especially because they're so interesting to learn about. And I found just personally and anecdotally, when a subject is fun to learn about, when it provokes curiosity and it's like fun to talk to other people about, then it's also in a way like easier to apply because I don't feel so attacked by it. It's not just like some boring idea or some shaming thing. It's more like, oh, this is so interesting that the human brain works this way. I see it working in me. And I think I would like to choose on my own volition to maybe make decisions differently with that awareness.
Absolutely. And I loved the part that you talked about rhyme as reason, which feels related to this.
Oh, yeah.
Where some kind of piece of rhyming information will not only stick in your mind, but maybe, you know, give you some kind of sense of pleasure with language.
Yeah, yeah. In that illusory truth effect chapter, which is really about like the power of repetition mm-hmm. in language to make you feel like something is true, I talk about like some other speech devices that make a statement feel truer, even if it's not. And yeah, one of them is rhyme. There's this effect called the rhyme is reason effect, which in studies of the rhyme is reason effect, researchers have found that the phrase woes unite foes is evaluated to feel more truthful than woes unite enemies, even though they mean the exact same thing. One of them rhymes. And so it really goes to show like the power of rhyming political slogans to, you know, spread information for better and for worse. And so, you know, like some of these linguistic tactics can be weaponized in a really dangerous way, but we can also use them for good as well.
The last question I want to ask you is, in your opinion, from your research, is there one bias that you think that as a culture and as individuals, or maybe a combination of biases, that would best serve us going forward in the information age, in the AI age, whatever's coming next? Is there one that you found was the one that you kind of wanted to scream from the rooftops to help everybody consume a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, the overconfidence bias one does come to mind because I find that we tend to demand overconfidence in our leaders, even when it behooves no one for them to have it. We like don't really accept very well when an expert claims not to know or not to have a definitive answer. That's not very engaging. It's not very comforting. And so, you know, whether we're talking to doctors or watching politicians give speeches or whether we're listening to business leaders, we really want them to portray overconfidence. And as the world becomes more, you know, volatile and technologically driven and things. Well, I guess not more, the world has always been pretty volatile, but as the world becomes more technologically volatile, I think it would really help for each of us to maybe like not expect and demand overconfidence as much in our leaders, because it will only incentivize them to bullshit us, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you, Amanda, so much. This has been such a great conversation. And I just loved your book. And thanks. I really hope that everybody goes and gets a copy of it, because it's information that was comforting to me, was scary to me, but also I think overall just like knowledge is comforting, even yeah. though a lot of times it's not yeah. comforting. So
yeah, it's all of it, everywhere, everything, all at once.
Exactly. And I know that you've got something coming up that's very exciting and very relevant to your book. Would you tell us about it?
Oh, yeah, of course. Well, yeah, so the book came out April 9th. And of course, I am not ready to stop talking about magical overthinking. So I am launching a podcast that was inspired by the book called Magical Overthinkers. And it will premiere Wednesday, May 15th, wherever you get your podcasts. And it's been so much fun to work on so far. Basically, every episode is dedicated to a different buzzy, confounding subject that we can't stop overthinking about, from narcissism to imposter syndrome. And I interview a really fascinating, charismatic expert guest about the subject to put our overthinking to bed once and for all.
Oh, man, I'm really excited for this. And I know that people can't subscribe on their podcast app yet, but you all can follow the show on Instagram at Magical Overthinkers.
Please do.
And Amanda, I'm so grateful that I got to have you on the show. And I really hope that you will come back someday, because I'm sure there are so many more things that we could talk about.
I would love that. Thank you for having me.
This was American Hysteria. Make sure you follow Amanda at Amanda_Montel on Instagram. And also make sure you pick up a copy of her book, The Age of Magical Overthinking. You can find those links in our show notes. If you want to get more of our show, or if you'd really like to support us, the best way you can do it is by going to patreon.com/American Hysteria or subscribe on Apple Plus. You'll get ad-free episodes, and you'll also get access to the other podcasts that I do with our producer, Miranda, Hysteria Home Companion, where we tell you stories that were left out of episodes or stories we think you'd really love. That's patreon.com/American Hysteria or subscribe on Apple Plus. Another really great way to help us out is to leave us a 5-star review on the app of your choosing. If you go to AmericanHysteria.com, you can pick up some of our merch, and you can leave us a message on our Urban Legends hotline about a tale that you remember from growing up, and we might do an entire episode about it. That's AmericanHysteria.com. Our producer and editor is Miranda Zickler, and our associate producer is Riley Swedelius Smith. And I'm your host, Chelsea Weber Smith. Thanks, as always, for listening, and I hope you have a great week.